On behalf of the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, it's my pleasure to welcome you all to today's training on groundwater statistics for environmental project managers, developed by the ITRC Groundwater Statistics Team. My name is Mary Yalkin. I'm coming to you from Lincoln, Nebraska. I will serve as your moderator today, and I will cover some introductory materials, and then I'll turn it over to the ITRC team. As listed on this slide, today's training is based off of our online guidance document, Groundwater Statistics, Monitoring, and Compliance. This training serves as an introduction to that guidance document, and we strongly encourage you to access that online document after today's training to learn more. Today's training is sponsored by the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, or ITRC, and hosted by the U.S. EPA Cleanup Information Network, or CLUIN. A few housekeeping items for today. This event is being recorded. Trainers will be in control of the slides as we move through today's presentation. If you want to control your own slides, you can download a copy of today's presentation in a PowerPoint form or PDF form at that initial CLUIN page you were directed to through your registration confirmation. You will have an opportunity to ask questions and provide your feedback. At any time during today's training class, you can click on that question and answer pod and submit a question. Some of those questions will be provided to you with direct response in that back to the individual in that Q&A pod. We will also have the opportunity at two designated question and answer breaks to answer questions verbally. And those will be about midway through, and the other will be at the end of today's session. We also ask that everybody complete the feedback form. We use that feedback not only to improve this training class, but also to improve future ITRC training courses that will be in development. If you do need confirmation of your participation today, please fill out that feedback form. Towards the bottom of that form, there's a box for you to check. Once you check that box and press submit, that will generate a confirmation email and a certificate for you to use to help document your participation. For more information about ITRC, you can find that on our website. ITRC is hosted by the Environmental Council of States. We are a state-led network, and we partner with our federal partners, including Department of Energy, Department of Defense, and the Environmental Protection Agency, along with participation from industry members through our Industry Affiliates Program, academia, and community stakeholders. The full ITRC disclaimer is included in the notes section of this slide and on the ITRC website. ITRC is partially funded by the U.S. government. ITRC nor the U.S. government warranty material or endorse specific products. We recommend you check with local, state, and federal laws and experts. We encourage you to use ITRC presentations and documents for educational purposes, both in your work and if you need to deliver training to others. Please credit ITRC, review the ITRC uses policy, and let us know the results and successes of your work. Use of ITRC materials for profit is not permitted. To learn more about ITRC technical and regulatory guidance documents, online training courses, classroom trainings, as well as how you can participate in ITRC, potentially by becoming a member of ITRC and participating in our technical teams, all that information is available on the ITRC website. At this point, it's my pleasure to introduce our trainers for today. All of them have been members of the ITRC Groundwater Statistics Team, which is led by Ninglu Chang of the California Department of Toxic Substances Control. Our first trainer today is Harold Templin. He is a senior geologist at the Indiana Department of Environmental Management in Indianapolis. He has designed or approved groundwater monitoring systems, sampling analysis plans, and statistical evaluation plans. Next, we will hear from Chris Stubbs. He's a principal consultant with Ramboll Environ. His specific areas of expertise include groundwater modeling, statistical analysis, risk-based site assessment and remediation, exposure analysis, and human health risk assessment. We will then hear from Liz Simmons, a principal geologist and technical practice leader for environmental characterization for Kleinfelder out of San Diego, California. Her extensive technical background includes numerous groundwater assessments, risk assessments, modeling, groundwater optimization, and litigation support. Next, we will hear from Randall Reite. He is a senior scientist with Neptune and Company in Los Alamos, New Mexico. His work includes ecological and human health risk assessments, supporting clients with groundwater over large spatial scales with multiple stressors, large and complex databases, and significant involvement with regulators, natural resource trustees, and the public. At this point, I'll turn it over to Harold Templin with the Indiana Department of Environmental Management to kick off our training. Harold?
Thank you, Mary. And as we start the training today, allow me to set the stage for using statistics to evaluate your groundwater data. In my work at the state of Indiana, I used to have mounds of groundwater data sitting on my desk, and people would come by and wondering, how do you know what to use? What is it? How is it that you have all this information? And very confusing. And I noted that these people were wondering, you know, about the idea of using statistics. Let me first of all say that to use statistics to evaluate your groundwater data, it demands that you have an adequate evidence of the data quality, that you have sufficient amount of the data, and that there's proper data management. So let me ask you, are you drowning in your data from your sites, groundwater data? And are you wondering, well, what data should I use from all this that shows up? And where do I start? Do I start at page 1 or do I start at page 6,700? And then what is all this data trying to tell me? And how do I use the data best? How can I get the most information out of this data? So that is questions that we hope to discuss today in our training. Another question is, can a statistical approach help manage your data? And we hope through today's training that you'll be able to say yes, that you'll be a more informed consumer of statistics, that you'll have confidence to spot misapplications and mistakes, and be able to review the selection of which statistical method or test to use, and just understanding the language of statistics. And then if you are a statistician, we feel like that this class will also help you with your work and make your conclusions understandable to the general audience. So this is ITRC's solution: the Groundwater Statistics and Monitoring Compliance, Statistical Tools for Project Lifecycle. So let's shorten that up and just say the GSMC document. This document is a web-based document, and it will, through this training, we hope that it's going to help you ask the right questions to apply statistics, direct you to the appropriate statistical method to use, and just maximize the value of the data that you have. ITRC formed this team back in 2011, and it, along with the state participants, we have experts from the Department of Defense, EPA, and the Department of Energy, along with members from the consulting community and industrial community. And this group of experts all came together to put together a very informative document, usable document, that will help understand using statistics at your groundwater data. The existing regulations on statistics vary across the states, and it may not, the regulation that you have may not recognize the advantages of using statistics or give the limitations on current statistical practices. And so let me just give you a couple of examples of how you might be able to use the statistical approach even where you don't have the requirement or the use of statistics in your program. And the first challenge I want to discuss is just meeting the criteria. as you see in this time series plot, where we have these 8 sampling points after active remediation was ceased, we wonder, okay, am I meeting the criterion? I have a bright line, red line up there is the criterion of 0.5 milligrams per liter. And we can see that, well, there's 2 consecutive values in the summer, and that each summer in June and then the following September or whatever, that we have these 2 values below the criterion, and then half the values are above the criterion. And with this, we have no certainty of whether we're meeting the criterion or not. I suggest that if you would use a statistical method like the upper confidence limit of the mean, you could give a certain amount of certainty to that selection. In this case, I'm sure Chris and Liz will be talking more about this later on, but in this specific case, the upper at the 95% confidence limit, the mean could be as high as 0.689 milligrams per liter, which is above the criterion. And so we at this point, we can say that we're not that confident that we're below the criterion and additional remediation should be continued. In another example, where we're discussing non-detect values, what we have here is a long history of values over many years, and through that period of time, there were different values assigned to the non-detect value. There was point, as you can see, there was point 0.01 milligrams per liter and 0.001 milligrams per liter. And then at one point, we had this almost outlier of where the had a matrix interference, and it was 0.09 milligrams per liter. So we're having many different values for non-detect, and so it becomes an issue. Okay, if we use simple substitution, what would we use? Would we use 0, as non-detect has no value, right? No, that isn't right. That many times that non-detect just means it's below the value. So as EPA used to have in their guidance was, well, use half the detection limit. Well, when we have a value as high as 10 times higher than in one of the non-detect values, this creates a problem. So what we suggest in our document is that you use the Kaplan-Meier method. And this, it basically is looking at the values that are reported and giving a approximation of the non-detect value next to it. And with this, we have an upper confidence limit of 0.0055 milligrams per liter. And in this case, where we were at 0.01 milligrams per liter as the criterion, we, instead of with a simple substitution, we show that though the value is less than the criterion. As I said, both Chris and Liz will be discussing more about the meaning of the upper confidence later and in the training, and you can go to the glossary or click on the UCL on the web-based document to find the definition for the upper confidence limit. As you can see, the statistical test shows that the upper bound of the mean at the 95% confidence level was below the criterion. So what we would suggest is the project managers, if you review or use statistical calculations for reports or make recommendations or decisions based upon statistics or try to demonstrate compliance for the groundwater projects, then we suggest that this document is for you. And with building upon your technical background and environmental experience in site compliance and cleanup, you can use this document even if you don't have a specific expertise in statistics or access to an in-house statistician. During this training, we will show you how. What we have here is the roadmap of what our training is going to consist of today. First, I'll give you an overview of how to use the document, how to navigate through the document, and then Chris will show you how to apply statistics to your groundwater data. After that, we'll have a question and answer period, and then we'll come back, and Liz and Randall will show you how to apply different study questions to your groundwater data and using statistics to answer those questions. Okay, with this web-based document, the GSMC document, what the team did was basically take three pillars to base the document upon. The first would be the project lifecycle. What we have found would be that groundwater statistical methods are applicable through all the project life cycles of an environmental project, and that these tests can help support decision making to move on to another phase of your project. Next, we identified specific different questions that would come up during the project life cycle. And so that the study questions were 10 questions that you would see. And if you were to click on one, let's say like, is there seasonality, it would take you to the appendix C of the document and discuss what seasonality means in your data and how to transform it or how to not make it misapply it and thinking that you had a statistical trend or something in that situation. Liz or Randall will be discussing that part of the test later on in our training. Then what we have is we have the statistical approaches, and what we see as the study questions build a bridge between the project lifecycle and the exploratory data analysis, the different statistical methods, and the software that you can use to answer those methods. With the understanding of this makeup of the web-based document, I want to show you specifically how to move around through the document, navigating through it. So if you were to come in, this is the first page of the document. And you click on this icon on the project life cycle stages, it'll take you to that section, section 4 of the document, and you can read about the different project life cycles and what different statistical tests you might have, different questions that you might have through that project. And then you can go to the study questions, as we said, in Appendix C, and if you have a specific question, then you click on that question, and it would describe the question and the different possible things that you could do to answer that question with the statistical methods. Then you click on the statistical methods, which is in Section 5, and it would give you the different methods that you could use to answer that question. Then last is the software tools that you could that you might use to run that statistical method. So all in all, that this outline and the web-based document can be used to get better decisions for your project. With it being the web-based document, it links itself within itself, but also to different documents as well. The unified guide, EPA's unified guidance is, this web-based document basically supports that, and we are linked to that document in the different calculations for the statistical method. Also, if you have in the data, we'll discuss data quality objective process as well later on in this, and then you can find in section 3 where they discuss the systematic planning tools based upon scientific methods that identify and define the type and quality and quantity of data that's needed, so that, as we discussed earlier, what data do I need? How much data do I need? You run it through the, you look at the data quality objective process and are able to answer those questions. And we discuss that in section 3 of the document. Then also, as we said, being a web-based document, it has references to many other documents, as you would find in section 9, with links to those. The ASTM methods, different textbooks on groundwater statistics, and other guidance on the DQO process. And with that, I think we're ready to turn it over to Chris to apply statistics to your groundwater data. So Chris from Rambo and Varon, you're on.
Okay, great. Thanks very much. All right, in this next section, we'll talk a little bit about statistics in general. First, just a quick definition. I like to think of statistics as the science of drawing conclusions from data, and has a bunch of tools that can help us visualize and understand our data, separate the signal from the noise, and for groundwater analysis, signal is usually changes in concentration in groundwater associated with a facility, and the noise might just be natural fluctuations or changes resulting from natural processes. We can also use some of the tools to summarize large-scale behavior. We have data from a bunch of different points, but we want to kind of summarize it over the larger scale. And the tools are generally will allow us to quantify uncertainty and make better and more defensible decisions. So that's what we'll look at a little bit in this section, is the major elements of a statistical approach. Before we get started with that, though, I just want to talk about a little crime story. And this is not a serious crime, just the burglary of a laptop from an office. And the police were able to apprehend a suspect, Mr. Ivan Shifty, and he was brought before the court, and he pled not guilty. So, and we can kind of think about the trial of Mr. Shifty as having some parallels to a statistical approach. So, as we all know, defendants at criminal trials are assumed to be not guilty, just going in. And in statistics, we can think of that as a null hypothesis, something that we assume at the beginning before we look at any of the data. And at a trial, of course, evidence is presented. In this case, Mr. Shifty had some pretty serious evidence against him. His fingerprints were on the stolen goods, and the stolen goods were found in the trunk of his car. So good evidence, but there has to be sufficient evidence to overcome this presumption of innocence. And the guilt has to be proven beyond a reasonable doubt. So that's kind of similar to what we do with some statistical tests, as we'll see. And the reason we organize our trials this way is we want to avoid making errors. Probably the most serious error is sending an innocent person to jail. In a statistical framework, that might be called a false positive error. And the other error is letting a guilty person go free. That might be called a false negative error. So, and usually one of these two types of errors is more important to us to avoid, and that's also the case when we're looking at groundwater data analysis. Typical way of organizing these types of errors is in a little table like this. So if we think now to the situation of site characterization, where we've got a new site and we're just kind of getting started investigating it, and we might kind of go in with the belief that the site is not contaminated because we don't have any reason to think it is. So that might be the null hypothesis from a statistical point of view. And then we have so the columns represent, you know, what we've decided based on our data. You know, have we decided that the site is not contaminated, or is the site contaminated? And then if we say it's not contaminated and we're actually correct, then we're in this box here. That's our correct conclusion. And if we, in other words, also say that the site is contaminated when it really isn't, then this would be that false positive error. And often in statistics, we use the Greek letter alpha to represent the probability that we've gotten that wrong, and that's often called the significance level of a statistical test. If we say it's contaminated and we're actually correct, that's great. And our ability to do that is usually called the power, and that's the 1 minus the probability that we got it wrong, or, you know, 1 minus beta is that usually the symbol that we use for that. So these are kind of the approaches we take to statistical decision making. As I mentioned, there's these two types of errors that we have to think about, and one of them is usually more important to us to avoid. So if we are, you know, at the beginning of site characterization, we basically don't want to not investigate a site if it's actually contaminated. So we want to make sure we have to avoid that kind of an error. And statistical significance is something we've all heard of a lot, and that's just generally the chance that if a result is statistically significant, that means there's a small chance that we've made a false positive error. And we get to select this probability, the significance level, and often we'll pick 5%, like they do in many medical studies. But this is a choice that we get to make, and many times we might want to pick a smaller significance level, that we have a smaller chance of making that kind of false positive error. And as I say, show here in some physics experiments, they choose a much, much smaller level so that they're more certain they're not making a false positive error. And then, of course, the false negative errors tends to be a little bit harder to figure out what that is, because it depends on the variability in the data and their sample size and the kind of the effect or the size of a difference that we might want to detect. So I have to remember to check that type of error as well. All right, so we're just going to go through the key aspects of a statistical approach. We start by developing a site conceptual model. We're all familiar with that. We begin by looking at the data in an exploratory fashion, usually by plotting it, seeing what we see in various graphs and summary tables. Think about a statistical sampling plan, and then we evaluate our data using a statistical method and trying to evaluate the evidence and uncertainty for a particular conclusion. And then we want to make sure we check our assumptions, make sure they're all valid. So we'll go through those in the coming slides here. So first is the conceptual site model, or CSM, just some sort of a summary of what's going on with the site. So, for example, it might be a figure, a graphical depiction of that. So in this example here, we have a landfill with groundwater flowing underneath it and discharging to a river over here. We have some monitoring wells where we sampled or tested the groundwater for specific conductance, which is just a measure of dissolved solids. And we're trying to decide whether this landfill impacted groundwater quality. We have a tidally influenced river over here, so this sample is actually a surface water sample. So we'll see here how we might use the conceptual site model to help answer this question. So we're just going to look at specific conductance in this example, even though you know, normally you would look at other parameters as well. There's two general approaches to answering this question. One is by using inter-well testing, where we would compare background wells with downgrading wells or potentially affected site wells to see if there was a difference between those. And the other approach is intra-well testing, where we just look at one well at a time. And we look at the data in that one well over two different periods, one before, for example, the landfill could have affected groundwater quality, and then one after. And we kind of compare those two different periods in the same well. And based on the conceptual site model, one of these approaches might actually be better. So in this case, just going back to this landfill, we see because of this tidal influence, you know, we might worry that this higher concentration of specific conductance here might actually just be from the river effect. So in this case, it would probably make more sense to use an intra-well testing approach so that we can better evaluate whether this landfill is impacting groundwater quality. Okay, going on here. Next thing to talk about is exploratory data analysis. And number one rule is just to plot the data. We have lots of different kinds of plots that we can use, and we'll go through kind of examples of many of these. Here's the top five plots that we'll look at. Time series box plots, scatter plots, histograms, and probability plots, all things to consider in certain circumstances. So first one of these is the time series plot. We've all seen this, where we look at the concentration, for example, over time. And we can use that for looking at trends or outliers, things like that. Just one thing to remember is to distinguish the non-detects from the detects by using a different symbol or some other way. Because we see here, when we actually indicate the non-detects with these open squares, that this doesn't look like there's actually a trend here other than in a trend in the detection limits. So that's just one thing to remember with time series plots. Now, box plots are more of a statistical plot, which you might not be as familiar with, but we use them to compare different groups of data. So if we have compliance wells and background wells, and we want to summarize the differences between them, box plots are a nice choice. So this line right here in the middle represents the median of the data. And then the upper and lower parts of the box are the 75th and 25th percentiles. Then we have these whiskers that kind of go out here that sort of show the general spread of the data, with some potential statistical outliers shown as individual data points that are outside of these whiskers. The nice thing about the box plot is it kind of summarizes both the central tendency of the data and then also the spread in the data and whether there's any outlier. So we kind of see that in this example here, the central tendency of these two is pretty similar, but the compliance wells have quite a bit more spread, and there's some potential outliers to look at. Scatter plots are quite useful for examining the relationship between two variables. For example, here we are showing the mercury concentration and the arsenic concentration measured in a particular well or set of wells, and kind of see a nice linear relationship between those two values, and that comes out nicely in a scatter plot. All right, so once we've kind of looked at our data and we kind of think about designing the statistical approach. Often it's useful, of course, usually useful to consider this planning process before you've collected all your samples, because We want to think about how to control these different types of decision errors and to think about how many samples we would need in order to do that. So that's good to do that planning beforehand. But then we also need to consider after we collect the data what kind of statistical power we have achieved. And we can only really do that effectively after we have all of our data. And this sort of sampling plan design does involve some trade-offs. It's good to sort of think about those. You know, we have the control over sample size, and we get to pick the significance level and the power as our controls on the different errors. And we also can think about the effect size, which is how big of a difference in two groups, for example, we might be interested in. A really tiny difference in concentration might not really be important to detect. So kind of think about the trade-off between these errors and sample size and as part of our planning process. All right, and then the next thing we would do after we got all of our data is to evaluate the statistical evidence for one conclusion or another. The first way we'll talk about doing that is using hypothesis testing. And this is sort of similar to that example of where we talked about the court case, where we start off going in with a null hypothesis or a presumption. So that was like the not guilty presumption. And we consider whether the evidence allows us to disprove that hypothesis or reject it versus an alternative hypothesis like guilty. So there needs to be enough evidence to overcome our presumption or to reject this null hypothesis, the certain burden of proof. So how we actually pick the null hypothesis depends on what we're doing. And in a way, we kind of pick the opposite hypothesis of kind of what we're actually interested in. So if our real question is, do the site concentrations exceed background, the null hypothesis we'd pick would usually be that the site concentrations are equal to background or equivalent to background. And if we're looking at whether cleanup goals have been achieved, then we would have a null hypothesis that the goals, cleanup goals haven't been achieved, that the concentration of the site is over the cleanup level. And then finally, if we're looking at whether there's a trend in concentrations, then the null hypothesis would be there's no trend or that the slope of a trend line is no different than zero. So generally, after we've picked our hypotheses, the next steps in a hypothesis testing approach would be to use your statistical software to take the data and calculate a test statistic. So we have to pick the right type of test. So for example, this would be like a t-test where we're trying to distinguish two different groups. And the software would calculate this test statistic under the assumption that the null hypothesis is true. And then we would look at the probability that, we could get that test statistic. If the null hypothesis is true, what would be the probability that we would see this type of data that we have? And if that probability is really small, and the probability is called the p-value, it's really small, so it's very unlikely that we'd actually see this data under the assumption of the null hypothesis, then we would reject the null hypothesis. We compare the p-value to our significance level, say 5%, whatever we had decided on, and that's how we would make our decision. And if we couldn't reject the null hypothesis, then we want to check to see that we really had enough data and a good enough power in our test to make a good decision. There's a lot of talk about p-values, and they're all quite, they have a sort of a similar purpose no matter what kind of test we're using, and they sort of measure this discrepancy between our null hypothesis and what we actually observe in the data. And so if we have a null hypothesis or a p-value that's really small, so it's very unlikely that we see this set of data if the null hypothesis were true, then we kind of can use it as a measure of the strength of the evidence. So very small p-values would represent stronger evidence. All right, so another approach to describing uncertainty and kind of reaching statistical conclusions is when we have, we've taken some data and we've summarized it, for example, found the mean concentration, like here we've got a mean concentration of 5.1 milligrams per liter, and we want to think about, well, how reliable is this? Obviously, that sort of depends on how much data we have and how much variability there is in the data. Statistical way of doing it is using statistical intervals, where we put like error bars on our estimates. There's different types of intervals. These confidence intervals are probably the most common one that most people are familiar with, but there's other ones called prediction intervals and tolerance intervals that are also useful in some cases. So, but generally, we use these intervals to indicate a confidence in our estimate. So if we have a 95% confidence level around our mean concentration, for example, then we kind of have a 95% probability that that interval will actually include the value of interest or the mean concentration. As we'll see, we can actually use these confidence intervals as an alternative way of doing hypothesis tests. That's quite useful when we're comparing data against fixed standards like MCLs or maximum concentration contaminant levels. So a little bit more here about these confidence and prediction intervals. So confidence intervals we just talked about, they're showing uncertainty in statistics, meaning things that we calculate from the data like means or medians or slopes. Now prediction intervals, another type of interval, and those are used to evaluate future samples. So not statistical measures, but actual future sample values to show how consistent they are with the existing data. So, for example, here we have some samples of total organic carbon, and these are the actual values that we've measured, shown here. And we can calculate the mean, shown by this blue dot here, and get a confidence interval around the mean. And that would be an example of the confidence interval. But the prediction interval is, you know, what would happen if we took another sample of TOC, you know, and then now we're not talking about the mean anymore, but just an additional sample. So it could be much wider. So prediction intervals are always wider than confidence intervals. So the confidence interval is around the mean, and the prediction interval is around future samples. One other thing I just want to mention here is that you can actually have one-sided intervals. Here I'm showing two-sided intervals as an upper and a lower level, but we can also have one-sided intervals with just, for example, the lower confidence level. All right, so just kind of compare how we would use these approaches in different phases of the life cycle. So if we're in the release detection phase, we go in usually assuming the site is clean, unless proven otherwise. So we would have a null hypothesis that, for example, the mean concentrations measured at the site are less than or equal to the MCL, or maximum contaminant level that we could allow. And then the alternative hypothesis is that they're greater. So we can also use a confidence interval to do that same kind of hypothesis test. And here we'd look at the lower confidence limit on the mean, and we would compare that to the MCL. Now, the lower confidence limit is kind of like as low as the concentrations could be. So we're kind of very conservatively comparing that to the MCL to see if there's any evidence that the site is contaminated. And if that lower confidence limit is greater than the MCL, then we reject the null hypothesis and assume that the site needed some additional investigation. Now, things are different when we're in the corrective action or remediation after remediation. Here we're going to assume that the site's actually contaminated unless we can show using the data otherwise. So we go in with the sort of opposite null hypothesis, and if we're going to think about the confidence, using the confidence intervals, here we would look at the upper confidence limit and compare that to see if it was below the MCL. And if it was, then we could conclude that that the remediation was successful with some good, you know, have some confidence in that, and we could stop doing remediation. Okay, so finally, we'll just talk a little bit about some of the assumptions that these statistical approaches rely on, and we need to kind of check them. So one thing that'll cause some issues sometimes is if you have lots of outliers or some outliers in your data, like shown here in this example. There's one data point that has a very high detection limit. And you want to kind of go back and identify these and check to make sure that they're not just a typo or something like that that can just be fixed. But if they're actually appear to be correct data, then you have to be a little bit careful of them. Sometimes you can just include them in your analysis, but then try the same analysis again by taking them out to just see how much of an effect they have on the conclusions. Often we have to test the statistical distribution of our data sets. Generally, we use only tests that involve normal, the assumption of normal or log normal or gamma distributions. And if we can show the data are consistent with one of these distributions, then we can use what are called parametric methods, which are methods that just rely on that assumption. They can sometimes be a bit more powerful, but if we find that the data really don't follow one of these standard distributions, then we can still use non-parametric methods. And sometimes it just makes sense to do use both and sort of see what you make sure you get consistent results with both types of approaches. Here we're showing here two types of plots that can be useful for assessing distributions. So first is the histogram. You can kind of see here we're generally seeing a normal distribution or a bell-shaped distribution, and another way of looking at that is with this normal probability plot, which is a bit more of a specialized plot, where if the data points, which are shown here, if the pluses sort of follow a straight line like they do here, then the data could be considered consistent with that distribution. Some other assumptions that we have to consider are spatial or temporal independence. So for example, if we collect samples, take a sample from a well and one day and then go back the next day and take another sample, it wouldn't really be appropriate to treat those as two separate independent samples because they're taken so close together, they're basically testing the same thing. And then sort of similarly, if you have wells that are too close together, you know, they won't really be independent samples. So we kind of can count those as separate samples when we're looking at the sample sizes. That's something you have to consider. Another assumption is the stability in background concentrations. Often we can't have trends in our background data like you sort of see in this example of toluene concentrations. You kind of see an upward trend in that data. So in some cases we'd want to, if we were going to compare these background data to site data, we'd want to either remove that trend somehow or look at different time periods so that we didn't have this obvious trend in the data. So finally, just some closing thoughts. Just a reminder to always plot your data, kind of see what it's looks like, get your general conclusions, and identify any issues that need to be followed up on. Think about whether you really have sufficient data to make a good decision with appropriate error rates. You want to think about both of those types of errors, the false negative and false positive errors, and determine whether you actually need more data or if you have sufficient data. It's important to confirm regulatory requirements for statistical analyses because those are quite different depending on the jurisdiction or program that you're in. You want to make sure you're following the right rules. Use statistical analysis along with other lines of evidence, hydrogeological analyses, things like that. You don't want to just look at the statistics. Just a quote here as a reminder that if you torture the data long enough, it will confess to anything. So that's just a reminder to use common sense and combine statistics with other lines of evidence to make sure you get the best kind of conclusions. So next, we're going to have a question and answer break.
Thanks, Chris. We do now have time for questions and answers. For those of you or any of you can type your question in the Q&A pod, and then we can either answer that directly back to you in the Q&A pod, or we can answer it verbally during the two designated question and answer periods, one now and then one at the end. I am going to go ahead and pull up a poll while we have our questions and answers going. So if you would like to answer that for us, please, you'll see the question is, select the areas where you use statistics on your project. Select all that apply. If you aren't able to see all the answers, you'll notice there's a scroll bar on the right-hand side. You can scroll down to see what all the answers are as you move through that section, then you can select the answers of interest. You can select all that apply there. We do have a couple questions that have come in. In just a moment, for those of you on the phone line, if you would like to ask your question verbally, I'll come back to you to do that. And you can unmute your phone by hitting #6. So the first question that we have is related to turbidity. And it says, turbidity, also known as matrix interference, is a problem at some older sites. It would be nice if more data looked like the example, and that was, I think, an example that was discussed in Harold's section. Lots of turbid samples in some of the older data. So not really a question, but more of a comment, but do any trainers have any insight or suggestions that they would like to provide this listener?
I guess I can just make a quick comment. So I do think that's true that we often see issues with our data from turbidity or other effects like that. So I guess my only point would be that is one of the uses of these statistical tools, is that we are trying to use the tools to help us distinguish the signal from the noise. So, and so turbidity would be kind of part of the noise in many cases. And if you have enough data and are using an appropriate statistical approach, you can kind of distinguish those things and try and figure out what's actually going on at the site.
All right. Thanks, Chris. I did want to open it up to the phone line audience. If there's any questions, please unmute your phone, and that's #6 to unmute. All right, let's go back to some of our simulcast questions. It says, explain exactly what is a non-detect.
Yeah, so I guess we talked a few times about non-detects. So generally, when you are collecting a sample of groundwater, you send it to the laboratory, and they will analyze do the analysis that you've requested and give the results back. In many cases, if the concentration that they've found is lower than they can quantify accurately, they'll report the results as a non-detect or like as a less than a certain limit. And there's different kinds of limits that can be used by the laboratory, reporting limits and quantification limits and method detection limits. So there's various kinds of limits, and it's important to understand those when interpreting the results. But from a statistical point of view, these types of data are called censored data. because we know that they're below a certain level, but we don't know exactly what they are. So there's some specific statistical approaches that can be used to handle this type of censored data, and those can be quite useful when we have analytical results. We have kind of a mixture of detects and non-detects, or things that are kind of below these reporting limits. So we talk about that a fair bit in the guidance. So it would be useful to look at that if you're trying to summarize these kind of data with non-detects.
All right, the next question, which of the software packages listed in the appendix to the guidance document is most generally applicable to doing the test you discussed today?
I don't think we've really talked about a specific test so much as just the general approaches of using hypothesis testing and calculating statistical intervals. But those are kind of basic things that most of the software packages that we've listed in there can be used, and I don't think we have a particular recommendation for particular ones, because it sort of depends on what's available to you and, you know, how much, you know, how expensive they are and things like that. So you might have to look through those and try some of them out to find the best kind of package, because we don't have a specific recommendation. But you'll see in the coming section some examples from particular software packages, so you can kind of get an idea of some of the capabilities of them in the next kind of section.
Right. The next question, what is MDL?
MDL, I guess, probably represents a method detection limit. So that's one of those detection limits that you might get from laboratory analytical results. So the method detection limit's usually one of the lowest limits that you might see. It's kind of like the best detection limit that analytical method could provide. But normally, for your particular data set, you would get a limit that's higher than that in some cases.
And along the lines of detection limits, the next question is there a preference to using the detection limit or half the detection limit to calculate statistical trends?
Yeah, I think as Harold kind of alluded to, whereas traditionally, or, you know, some years back, the very standard practice would be to use half the detection limit in many statistical analyses. More recently, there's been some move towards using other approaches, the probably most common ones called the Kaplan-Meier method, which allows you to actually treat that non-detect as a less than value in the statistical analysis, so it gets treated a little bit more appropriately and more accurately, I guess. And so that would be the kind of approach that we'd recommend using. And those are all described in the guidance document.
How do you determine whether you have sufficient amount of data?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. The EPA kind of approach to that is called the Data Quality Objectives process, or DQO process. But essentially, you go through and look at your number of data points, think about what are the appropriate statistical error rates that you would find acceptable for false positive and false negative errors. And then you would be able to, once you've made some assumptions about variability in your data and what you're trying to test, they could kind of see what sample sizes you would need in order to meet those error rates. So if you want more certainty, obviously you need more samples, and that's kind of our recommendation, is you kind of go through that process to figure out the number of samples. And many of the software packages have ways of helping you do that are pretty straightforward.
Can you please discuss how to determine whether outliers should be included or excluded in analysis?
Yeah, that's a good question. Generally, if you've looked at the outliers and kind of gone back to the lab report and confirmed that it's actually the value is correct, then we don't recommend throwing it out just because it's an outlier. So you should include it in the analysis. But if you're concerned that it's going to make a big difference in the analysis, like I said, you might try running the analysis a second time, excluding that, to determine whether that would lead you to change your conclusion based on whether the outlier was included or not. And if the outlier was very significant on your conclusion, then you might want to consider resampling or collecting additional data to really answer that question appropriately.
What do you do if well sampling was done using a submersible pump and then later by a bladder pump yielding lower metals results?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, I guess if you have these two types of sampling approaches and you have some concerns about whether they're really comparable, you know, you might have to try and evaluate those data separately. You could kind of try and compare them to each other to see if there's really a significant difference between data collected by different approaches. And if they're really just turned out to be quite different, then I guess you would have to just sort of make a decision about whether you just needed to collect data using only one approach or the other, because combining the data might be a little tricky if you're getting significant differences between them.
Why is it necessary to remove trends if they can be showing that there's a tendency?
Yeah, I guess that's probably a reference to the slide on the assumptions that the background data don't have a trend. Sometimes, of course, you are interested in looking for trends, but I think in that slide about the assumptions for no trend in background, it's just that the tests that you are using to compare background data to the site data have the assumption that there's no trend. So then you can use that test if there is a significant trend, or you have to somehow address that by either, you know, you can kind of remove the trend from the data or look at subsets of the data that maybe don't have a trend.
What is a good example to use interwell stats versus intrawell stats?
Well, inter-wells analyses, where you're kind of looking at groups of wells and comparing them against each other, usually of the background set of wells, and the downgradient wells are the ones that are measuring the site effect. So as long as there's no external influences on those wells, then, you know, it makes perfect sense to do that. If the only thing that could be changing the downgradient wells from the upgradient wells is the site itself, then an interwell approach would make sense, and that's usually the case. So that would probably be more commonly used than the intrawell testing.
Let's do a check-in with our phone line audience. If you have a question, please go ahead and state that verbally. All right, we'll move on to another one of our written questions. It says, on trend graphs, should non-detects ever be represented as zero, or should the limit of the detection used with a different symbol representing the non-detect?
Yeah, I think in general, if you're showing a graph that it makes sense to actually put the detection limit itself with a different symbol to indicate that it's a non-detect, because that kind of gives you the sort of information you need to understand that data point the best.
What are different statistical approaches for analyzing non-detects data?
Well, like I said, there's the kind of traditional approach would be to replace the non-detect with half the detection limit. In some cases, that's still okay to do, but generally the recommendation now is to use this Kaplan-Meier type approach, or a non-parametric trend analysis that can handle non-detects and actually treat them as less than values. So I think we'll see some examples of that in the coming sections, but those are all kind of described in the online guidance. You can kind of look for those.
All right. Thanks for all your questions, and thanks to our trainers for responding. We do need to move on to the second portion of our training today. If we haven't gotten to your question yet, our trainers will answer some of those directly back to the individual in the Q&A pod. Others we will try to answer in the next question and answer period. So let's now move on over to our next slide, and I will turn it over to Liz Simmons with Kleinfelder. Liz?
Thanks, Mary. What we're going to do right now is to start taking the information that Harold and Chris have gone through and apply it to, some of the study questions that we have. So the examples that we're going to present here are basically the application of statistics to the groundwater sites. So in these next few sections, we're going to go through some study questions, the applications, and how to use the project life cycle to highlight the concepts and statistical methods that that Harold and Chris just presented, and how these could apply to some typical questions that might be asked. Now, because of the time involved, we're not going to be able to cover all the questions in the training, but we're going to give you kind of a flavor of what's in the guidance document. If you want to get into further discussions of the study questions, they're found in Appendix C of the document. Since groundwater statistical methods have applications throughout the life cycle of environmental projects, we're going to use the project life cycle stages and the study questions to illustrate the connections to some hypothetical sites that we have. These questions were developed by the team to kind of easily navigate through some typical issues and questions that may come up during various phases associated with groundwater monitoring and also ways to evaluate the data. So if we're looking at the tables here, the table on our left, we show the project life cycle stages, this time as columns, and the study questions are listed on the right. The study questions that generally apply to each of the life cycle stages are noted with the X's in the table on the left. In the guidance document, this is the main tool we use to connect between life cycle stages and study questions, and it's used to help the reader find information that's relevant to their particular site. The first concept we're going to discuss is background. For background, study questions 1 and 2 are applicable. For study question 1, what are the background concentrations, applies to life cycle stages for release detection, site characterization, and closure. For study question 2, are concentrations above background applies to release detection, site characterization, monitoring, and closure. So, what is background? Sometimes the concept of background can vary from state to state, but what we're talking about here is site-related versus not site-related. In general, both native and man-made sources need to be taken into account. However, a baseline must be established, because groundwater may already be tainted with concentrations of a contaminant from either native or man-made sources that would make it difficult, if not impossible, to clean up to what might be considered a pristine standard. And the web-based guidance document addresses these in more detail. Background is usually tied to some sort of a regulatory threshold, whether it's a criterion like an MCL, a risk-based criterion, or some other threshold. Now, back on slide 31, Chris discussed intra-well versus inter-well, and he also went through this a little bit during the study questions. And consider it as a time-only relationship versus a time-space relationship. For intra-well samples, you're sampling the same well many times, so what you're looking at is essentially a before, if possible, a during and after contamination picture. And natural factors typically don't affect intra-well samples, only what happens over time. For inter-well samples, you're comparing different wells. Generally, you're comparing what you're considering as an upgradient or background well with downgradient compliance wells. And so here, you're evaluating samples over both space and time. So when we're evaluating background, what do we need to consider? The first thing is known sources. And what we're referring to here are how many sources are not related to site contamination. The distance and direction of geological, hydrogeological information, for example, estimated groundwater gradient, if you've got fracture flow, evaluation of intra-well versus inter-well data. You need to look at multiple aquifer characteristics. For example, do you have a perch zone? Are there multiple aquifers? And if so, you're not going to want to cross-contaminate. You need to take a look at your data quality objectives, and these should be developed up front before you do anything else. You need to make sure that you have a sufficient number of samples to provide reliable results and that the quality of your data set is sufficient. For example, if you've got a lot of old data, you might have multiple detection limits or, you know, if you've had multiple labs run that data. Basically, you need to develop a good conceptual site model to maximize the validity of your assumptions. As Chris talked about in the previous segment, we should use exploratory data analysis methods to help us evaluate potential background data sets. And this is discussed in detail in sections 3.3.3 and 3.5 in the guidance document. An initial step would be to simply inspect the data to determine the frequency of detection, representativeness of samples, whether there's one or multiple detection limits, the time span of the data, can some of your data be too old? You might not want to use that. And consistency of analytical methods. For example, if you've got a BTEX plume, you may be looking at, over time, EPA methods 80-20, 80-21, or 80-260. So you need to take a look at, you know, everything that you've got in front of you. And to get a quick visual, use graphical methods such as histograms, quartile plots, box plots, or scatter plots to plot the data set to provide insight into the overall spread and potential distribution of that data. You also need to determine the distribution of the data set to figure out whether it's parametric, for example, whether it's normal or log normal, or non-parametric, where it may not fit the normal distribution or there may not be enough samples. And also, which statistical methods will be needed for your evaluation of background? For example, the t-test, which is a parametric test, is sensitive to outliers. We're going to kind of move into some examples here. And most regulatory governance, for example, RCRA, requires the establishment of background. And this example shows how potential background well data can be evaluated to determine whether the data set can be used to characterize that background. This example applies to study question one, what are the background concentrations, and also study question two, are concentrations greater than background concentrations? For study question one, we'll use descriptive statistics, and we'll use inferential hypotheses for study question two. This example site shows a hypothetical metal recycling site where arsenic is the primary chemical of concern and a groundwater plume has already been characterized. For this site, the conceptual site model has already been completed, it's been validated, the hydrology has been studied, And based on the hydrogeology, the upgradient wells are wells W1 and 2. The side gradient wells are wells W6 and W8. And the wells downgrading of the plume are wells W3, 4, 5, and 6. So we've already got that set up. And this is based on the conceptual site model. The objective here is to identify a data set that would be consistent with background. And we first would select a potential data set and then evaluate the quality, the shape, and the distribution of that data set. We look at what are the potential data quality objectives, and how do they apply to the number of samples that are required. We need to look at, are there non-detects that must be addressed? And Chris has gone through this in quite some detail. And does the data have a stable mean and a variance? And are there trends? Are there outliers? And what's the distribution? Here we've selected a data set for the two hydrogeologically upgradient wells over a two-year period. And for our purposes, this should give us a sufficient number of samples to meet our data quality objectives. In this particular data set, there's no non-detects, and both upgradient wells are also below the MCL. There's a number of methods and tools to do preliminary statistical analysis. For example, you can use probability plots or time series plots. And for interpretation of the results, you need to understand the source of the variation. For example, is it natural or man-made? The environmental settings. And you know, if you can get any information from research or public study or published studies, that also helps. You need to take a look at temporal changes. For example, is it a rainy season versus a dry season? And you also need to look at the presence of outliers. Then, based on your analysis interpretation, does your conceptual site model need to be revised? It may need to be. And just remember, conceptual site models are living documents, and if there appears to be another upgradient source, you need to update your conceptual site model. In this case, based on the graphical methods we've used, well, W1 appears to be fairly consistent with that expected for a background well, where W2 has a couple of points or outliers that may be called into question. Upon further research, these two points both occur in April when there's a larger runoff from the mountains where there are higher arsenic concentrations in the rocks. Therefore, both these can be considered as background wells. More often, though, a specific reason for your outliers isn't known. And this is where statistical methods may come in handy in being able to manage that outlier data. Okay, next we're going to discuss how statistics apply to monitoring compliance. And for monitoring compliance, we move to study questions 3 and 4. For study question 3, are the concentrations above or below a criterion applies to life cycle stages for release detection, site characterization, remediation, monitoring, and closure. And for study question 4, when will that criterion be met, applies to project life cycle stages for remediation, monitoring, and closure. Now, because of the time constraints, study question 4 won't be addressed in this particular internet-based training, but we will address study question 3. Why do we do monitoring and evaluate site characterization? Well, we have to, site characteristics can be evaluated based on a combination of spatial and temporal data. And to evaluate the chemical concentrations for compliance with groundwater protection criterion. For monitoring design, you need to evaluate the presence of chemicals over time. What are your potential contaminants? For example, if you've got chlorinated hydrocarbons, how have they changed over time? You could have, you know, PCE, TCE, or vinyl chloride. Monitoring design is also used in identifying a release and developing a conceptual site model. and evaluating compliance with your regulatory requirements. So groundwater criterion compliance is based on a number of things. It can be based on an MCL, background concentrations, a risk-based value based on some sort of an exposure scenario, or an eco-protection value. And compliance measures should be presented in a quality assurance project plan. And this will, for example, give you the number of samples that you need. You need to look at the distribution, once again, whether it's parametric, normal or log normal, versus non-parametric, where it doesn't fit normal distribution or there's not enough samples. It can be a regulatory threshold, which could vary depending on what compliance criteria you're addressing. And also, you know, what's the compliance point you're looking at? Is it a number, a maximum limit, or a set value? So there's a number of things that you can look at as far as what the basis of compliance would be. Now we're going to move into our monitoring compliance example, where we're going to focus on study question 3, are concentrations above or below a criterion? And once again, we're looking at our hypothetical metal recycling facility. And let's remember here that we've already determined that wells 1 and 2 are our background wells. Wells 7 and 8 are our side gradient wells, and they are outside the plume. And wells 3, 4, 5, and 6 are our down gradient wells, and they are either in the plume or directly down gradient of that plume. So for this question, we're going to be focusing on wells W3, W4, W5, and W6, which, as I said, are within the plume or down gradient of the suspected source. Here is our data set for wells W3 through W6. It's got the same number of samples and data ranges as we saw in wells W1 and W2, and it meets our data quality objectives. There are no non-detects in this data set. And note that the data set here presented mimics an actual laboratory data set where higher concentrations tend to have fewer significant figures based on threshold detection limits. Also, based on our conceptual site model, well, W3 is closest to the source. Yeah. And W4 is farthest away from the source. So what we're looking at here is W3 is closest, and it goes down gradient to the farthest away. So that's what we're looking at right now. All right. Let's take a look at W3 and W6 first. And if you look at these, the first thing you may notice is that samples from W3 are about 6 to 9 times the MCL. And samples from W6 are about twice the MCL. But there's also less variation in the data than you see in well W3. Now, samples from W4 are all below the MCL. And they're fairly consistent, while samples from well W5 straddle both sides of the MCL and have a slightly larger spread. For W3, W4, and W6, you may not need statistics. That may be true, but it's also a misconception because there's always uncertainty in the results. And the real usefulness here are in the sample results for well W5, which is the harder case. All right now, Chris previously discussed data distributions and confidence intervals in his segment. And as we're evaluating the data from the four wells in our example, we need to look at confidence intervals. And as I said, Chris has already discussed this. I believe Harold's discussed this as well. And they're also discussed in detail in the guidance document. Now, there's many kinds of confidence intervals, but they bind a single population. A mean or an average is a typical confidence measure, and the mean is shown here as the horizontal. Let me try to move this, and it's not moving. The horizontal colored lines, for example, you have the horizontal green colored lines on W3 and the horizontal blue colored lines on W4. And the mean is based on multiple observations so that a decision can be made with statistical confidence. For example, 1 point doesn't prove the mean or max is below a certain criterion, and one above it does not violate that criterion. Now, the vertical black arrows that are shown here show the confidence interval on the mean for the different well sample sets. For example, the variability of the confidence interval for the W3 sample set, which is in green, is greater than that for the W4 sample set, which is down at the bottom right, in the blue. And if you look at it, you can, you know, tell the difference in that quite easily. Confidence intervals can also be measured around other things such as an upper percentile or a median. And percentiles can vary too, depending on your risk tolerance. But 90, 95, and 99 are typical values that we use for percentiles. And the number of samples required to calculate the confidence interval for your site should be based on the data quality objectives. And there should be a sufficient number of samples to compensate for the variability of your data, uncertainty, whether you have false positives or false negatives. Now, this particular site happens to be in the state of Washington. And as I said, this is a hypothetical site. It's not real. And since it's in Washington, we must use the guidance that's been designed by the state. It should be noted that this is only one method, and it doesn't match up with what's in the unified guidance, but this is what the state has chosen. In the guidance document, we talk about regulatory barriers for various states. And Harold's also mentioned this previously in his segment. After we go through the Washington State guidance, we'll do an example of this project as a requisite that uses the unified guidance. And these two examples are given just to illustrate how results of statistical analysis are used and that they're used in different ways by different regulatory agencies. When you're looking at CLEAN, CLEAN will most likely be based upon a state-prescribed basis that may or may not be statistically based. In this example, the data from wells were evaluated using the State of Washington compliance test, which starts out with a comparison of the 95% UCL, and that's what we have up here on this graph. So what I'm going to go through now is how our example meets up with the State of Washington guidance. So the first question is the upper 95% confidence interval on the mean less than the cleanup standard? And for well W3, that would be no. Well W6, that's no. 5 is no. And 4 is yes. The second criterion is the maximum data point value less than 2 times the cleanup standard? And for wells W3 and W6, that answer is no. And for wells W5 and W4, that answer is yes. And finally, are 10% of the data above the cleanup standard? And for wells W3, W6, and W5, that answer is yes. And W4, that answer is no. So if we're looking at this from the State of Washington standards, wells W3, W6, and W5 are not in compliance, and well W4 is in compliance. So the main question here is, if the concentrations remain above the groundwater protection criterion, then when will the site be in compliance? All right, now let's move to a RCRA example. So as referenced in our guidance document, when you're looking at a RCRA situation, and that's based on 40 CFR 264.99, the U.S. EPA's unified guidance document is typically used. And let's take a look at the same site based on that guidance. As Chris described earlier, from a release detection point of view, the MCL represents an average concentration, and the appropriate statistical test is the null hypothesis, with the mean less than the groundwater protection criterion. And this is where the mean is assumed to represent the true mean concentration. We conclude that a well's in compliance when the lower confidence limit of the mean is less than the groundwater protection criterion. So in other words, because we don't know what the true mean is, we assume that it could be any value within the confidence interval that we've calculated. So even though the mean might be greater than the groundwater protection criterion, we're not out of compliance until the lower confidence limit is also greater than the mean. In the table we've got here, we've calculated the 95% confidence interval for the mean concentration of each well under the assumption that the data were normally distributed. To evaluate distribution, you can also use distributional tests, which are described in Section 5 of the online guidance. To figure out if your data follow a particular distribution, you need to kind of calculate that ahead of time. So look at the assumptions in your test, and once you've done that, then we compare the lower confidence limit to the arsenic MCL of 10 micrograms per liter. And when the lower confidence limit was greater than the MCL, we concluded that we're out of compliance, and vice versa when the lower confidence limit was less than the MCL. So in this example, well W3 and W6 are out of compliance, and well W4 and W5 are in compliance. So you got to keep in mind, though, that the assumption that we just used is from a release detection perspective, where the null hypothesis is that the well is in compliance. If the groundwater protection criterion falls below the upper confidence limit, then the null hypothesis won't be rejected unless the groundwater protection criterion is also below the lower confidence limit. To be sure, the background concentrations exceedances don't predetermine any relationship of those increases versus the groundwater protection criterion. Now, for remediation or corrective action, the null hypothesis is actually reversed, so it's a complete 180 for what we were just looking at. And again, you know, what I wanted to do here was just demonstrate the differences in regulatory framework. Now, I'm going to turn the time over to Randall Ridey from Neptune & Company, and he is going to tell us a little bit about trend analysis and monitoring optimization. Randall?
Yeah, thanks, Liz. So I'm going to cover a couple more of the topical areas in the online guidance document. And one thing I'll note is that when you looked at the answer to the survey we had just before this segment began, a lot of people said that they were had used trend analyses. And so just point out here that for people who are familiar with it, you may not be needing to use the guidance document so much for yourself. You may want to refresh yourself on some of the assumptions, but it's also a good tool if you want to direct a colleague to understand a little more about the tests you're proposing, or if someone's reviewing it, they can help look at some of the details on the methods that you're applying. So I think that's one of the nice things about the online guidance document is if you know something that you're trying to find, you can find pretty quickly, or somebody's unexperienced with the area, they can go and just start from scratch. So, and for those of you that happen to be following along in your own package, we're on slide 65, heading into the rest of the presentation here. Okay. So, we have identified four of our study questions that relate to trend analysis. So I'll note here that question 8, changes with distance. Again, as let's say we couldn't cover everything in this, we're not covering that particular question in this training. I refer you to section 5.15 of the online web-based guidance document for more information on that particular topic. Well, So again, just to reiterate something that we've covered here before is, plot your data. Picture's worth a thousand words. Of course, just plotting your data doesn't give you all the information you might want. You know, when you plot the data, you get some good information. You know, the numbers appear to be kind of going up and down. Are they generally going up over time or not? Well, if you do some statistical analysis, in this case, we just have applied simple linear regression to this plot, data plot, and it shows that there's an overall increasing concentration. So the analyte concentration starts around 2 and goes just to over 2.25. So it's not a large trend, but there is some trend over time. The other thing I guess I'll note about this regression is that, you know, anytime you fit a model to the data, something useful to think too is, well, I fit a model, and that's the model. So I basically reduced all this information to this one line. Well, there's a lack of fit. So in here, in this case, we see there's some points above, points below. Linear regression is basically splitting difference in the residuals above and below these points. It's showing there's overall increasing trend, but maybe there's something else going on that you might be concerned about. So that's something general and good to think about any time you have a model. Okay, well, what about trend applications? So I actually got a question about this first one. So in terms of exploratory data analysis, we covered this before, our background level stable and why you might be concerned about that. You know, statistical jargon for this is something called independent and identically distributed. So basically you want your background data to have that property. So that means that you can't have a trend over time. And you can imagine some situations where, you know, if you're doing testing and you have a trend overall, like Liz was talking about, maybe a seasonal trend, if you collect your background samples from when the concentrations tend to be high and compare your potentially impacted wells when it's low, then you're getting a biased result. So that's kind of the most obvious case where you're having an issue. You don't really have comparable data. So you're comparing apples and oranges because there's a trend in your data and you didn't account for it. And that's something to look for when you're looking at reviewing projects and their results. Do they look for this kind of pattern? They look for this basic background levels being stable or not. And, of course, there's some other purposes for trend analyses. That's why it's so commonly applied. Basically, the data are collected at a well over time. And you might be looking at, you know, release detection, concentrations increasing steadily. You might be understanding if monitored natural attenuation is possible because concentrations are actually decreasing at some point. And we'll talk about optimization in the next section of this training, so I won't really cover it much more here. Okay, what about a couple of examples? So again, these are our hypothetical examples. In this case, highlighting something we have also in the web-based guidance document is Appendix A, which has some examples illustrating some of the methods. This is a plot of data, and it's changing a lot, so it's a log scale plot. That's one of the things when you're reviewing data, obviously you need to look at the scale, so this is on a log scale. So the concentrations are actually changing over more than a factor of 10, over order of magnitude of concentration over time. And what we're showing here originally is just the unadjusted data. In this case, all the data are detected. They're just the raw data measurements. And they're collected in seasons. And so this is just showing that we have data collected in October as one of the sampling events, one of the seasons where the data are collected. The other thing that you can see on here, a couple other things just for showing how the adjusted are calculated. You have an overall mean, so when you're evaluating the data set, you have an overall mean over this period of time. And then basically you have an event concentration. So you have the October tends to be the highest concentration, so they're a little bit higher. You can imagine also if you were doing this analysis, well, I could just look at the data simply and say, well, let's just plot the trend in just October. There was a benefit in just not only using one query data, so this method allows you to use all the data from the different seasons. So it basically comes up with using analysis of variance type method, you come up with this red line here in the middle. The red line in the middle is are the adjusted seasonality removed results, and so they have considerably less variation than the original raw data over this period of time. Okay, well, what can we do with this data set? So looking at this again, continuing on with this example, you might be interested in the trend. You know, what's the trend in the seasonality adjusted group of data? And here we've illustrated two different methods So again, this linear regression, which is what we call parametric methods, so it's assuming the data are normally distributed, or in this case, they're log normally distributed, so the linear regression is based on the logs of the data. Another one is the nonparametric method. Till send line comes from a nonparametric suite of methods. And in this case, they came out about the same. The results were not showing, meaning to imply that you just pick the results you use and you use multiple methods. Just to illustrate for the purposes of the guidance document what you can do with these different methods. And it's not surprising they're not different between the linear regression, the blue line, and the red line just above it, because they are log normally distributed. So they're probably going to come up with about the same results in this particular case. And the method that you would use would be the linear regression method if you're trying to come up with an estimate of the trend over time. Okay, well, what about getting into other questions and examples? So you have, again, your data set. And so this is an example we got from Kurt Cameron. So this is now on a different scale. You can see that it's not log. It's a linear scale over time. And it's a fairly short period of time. So this is maybe one of the better examples of where you're actually showing a concentration decrease. Maybe there's some active remediation going on in this case. But you have a data set that's thinking about Harold's pile of data. Originally, just a bunch of numbers. You plotted it over time. And we're just showing this overall trend over this 2.5 period of time, and it's a fairly significant trend. It's going down by a factor of, you know, 5 maybe over this period of time. Well, it might be interesting in a couple of questions, and you can use this data set to say, well, have we attained our cleanup level? And you could just, you know, say, well, here's the first value. We did attain the cleanup level at this sampling event right here. Right there, we've got that sampling event. Well, but what about uncertainty in terms of this relationship? We have, in this case, a pretty nice relationship over time, and so there's what comes from this teal send line right here in the middle is showing the overall trend. But like with all statistical methods Liz was talking about and Chris talking about earlier, there's a confidence bound. That's what this is. There's a confidence bound around that best fit line. And you can say, well, at what point did we actually have a less, you know, the 90%, upper 90% limit was below the line. You can say this is, you know, gives a pretty convincing argument rather than just giving the data saying, well, we did attain it. It's showing a nice trend over time, and it's better information maybe for decision making than just taking the data and saying, well, after 22 months, we attained the cleanup level. You can give somebody more specific information on what the trends were and what we expect to see in the future. And this is interpolation. So basically, we have a data set. We have, in this case, 2.5 years of data, and we're looking at whatever is happening within that period of time. So now the next example we're going to talk about is an extrapolation. So we have a period of time, and we're trying to think about what's going to happen in the future. So this is also an example we have in the web-based guidance document. This is continuing on with this example 8.2. So it's that same data set we were looking at a couple slides ago with pretty wildly varying concentrations. So again, we have order of magnitude plus concentration variation here over time. And now we have is just shown the data set. And here's where we have measured data. So this is the range, you know, the median basically of where we have measured data at this point here, the dotted line. And then we can look at the model that we have. So if you look at this model, and we think about something we've seen a lot this year, hurricane forecasts. So the bounds on this model, so here's the model right here in the middle, the blue line, going down over time. And then we have these confidence bounds. The confidence bounds are getting wider as we get away from where we have measured the data. And this makes some sense because we have uncertainty about what the future is in terms of what changes might be over time. So in essence, the best case scenario is right here. The best case scenario is that this contaminant will reach this cleanup level at this time, so around 2020. Oh, what's the worst case? The worst case is actually off the scale of this plot, so it's after 2060. So it's quite a range. So, and when you think about the model, what the model is in this case is really the slope of this line. So this, what's being plotted on the blue line is our best estimate of the slope. Well, there's some uncertainty in what the slope might be. The slope might be steeper which is giving us more this best case scenario, or it might be more shallow, which is more this worst case. So the confidence bounds incorporate, in this case, the model is fairly simple, and like a hurricane forecast, what is the uncertainty and the trend over time? So again, this is extrapolating, and it's you have, in essence, inherent more uncertainty when you're extrapolating into the future. There could be other factors as to why this model may or may not be accurate, but this is just one statistical way of looking at the uncertainty in a trend model and extrapolating over time. Okay, well, that kind of sets us up for monitoring optimization. So for monitoring optimization, we have a couple questions, and people have already asked questions about, well, how many samples are enough? Well, basically, that's what we're doing with monitoring optimization is we have identified two study questions. So one is, do we have adequate sampling frequency? So do we have adequate number of events, you know, per year or whatever cycle we want to look at for a particular well? And the other question is, do we have adequate spatial coverage? Do we have adequate number of wells to characterize whatever aspects of this plume or its dynamics we're trying to characterize? So it's kind of basic, DQOs. Do you have enough? You want to have make sure you have enough data, the right amount of data for making decisions. And in statistical parlance, what we're trying to do is remove any correlation or redundancy we have in the results, but still maintaining enough data so that we can make an accurate decision. So again, this is probably thinking about it in terms of confidence bounds on your data, or on estimates based on your data, like the mass of contaminant and plume, things like that. Well, temporal optimization. Oh, sorry, one thing I forgot to mention. I think everyone probably is familiar with the other class we have, which is kind of companion to this one, the geostatistics remediation optimization. But that's a good class, and they actually have a lot more information on the spatial aspects of optimization and interpretation of data, so it's well worth your time to look into that class and to consider taking it. Okay, but that, back to the temporal optimization. So temporal optimization basically is looking at your data set and you have consecutive events, and Chris talked about this problem with when you collect data. So again, if you have data collected too close together in some sense, it means that they're no longer independent. They're basically the same sample, and in the most extreme case is basically like a duplicate collected at the same time, right after one another. So we know those aren't independent. And the question is, at what point in time are samples independent? And this could relate to a lot of different things, whether or not there's seasonality or any other kind of trends in the data set. But the way the statisticians look at this is, autocorrelation, basically looking at consecutive events, and then you look at, over one month period you might have data, 2 month period, 3 month period, annual period. You can look and see, is there a relationship between the samples collected at a particular, in essence, lag, difference between them? Are they basically giving you very similar results or not? And so that's how you determine whether or not samples are redundant. And so there's no purpose in collecting samples if they're redundant, because you're not really changing any information in some sense you have on your trend. So that's kind of the idea in doing temporal optimization. And you could imagine that, one approach is you could just, take this and manually go ahead and, take your data sets and look for these kind of trends. And this is one of the questions we got also, was about software tools. Well, luckily there's some software tools that are out there that can, automate this process for us. So again, in our Appendix A, so this is our example A.4, we illustrate the temporal, this approach. It's called iterative thinning. And this is usually a software called Visual Sample Plan. So I kind of walk you through this plot and what's on it. So the first thing we have are the original data. So in this case, the original data are plotted as these black circles. You can see them around here, around the plot, and you can see that a lot of the points fall within this fitted line data. So what the software has done is taken the original data, and it's come up with a smooth data set, so basically an interpolation of the data here with these red filled circles. And then the other thing it's done is it's created a confidence interval around, so this blue line on the top and the blue line on the bottom and on the top, gives us the confidence interval around the fitted data. So just again, when you're thinking about data and models, one thing just to point out is that there are some points here. Here's some points that are not within the 90%. Here's some other points that are not within 90%. Let's just keep that thought for a second. So when we run the analysis is giving us an answer in terms of, well, you know, when I take the data set and I remove a certain fraction of it, how much can I remove and still keep this trend? I would still keep this same trend. And the solution that Visual Sampling Plan VSP got was every 227 days. So that translates to, you'd say, well, every 6 months, 180-ish days would be work for us. Now, when you're interpreting the results of an optimization, and it's important to keep in mind, like I said, well, there's some points here that are low, and maybe that's okay, that there's some real values that are less than what we fit here. So maybe that's okay that we have those. So we actually have the other example doesn't have this issue. But it could come to the conclusion as to whether or not, you know, is it you want to believe what the model gives you, given that there's some points that are outside of what it's basically fit. We expect some points outside the 90% confidence interval. Maybe these are more than we would like to tolerate. So again, when you're getting a result from a statistical optimization, you need to look at it in the context of your original data, you know, what models they may have used to fit it, and then what results they have and whether or not there's some lack of fit that you're concerned about in terms of the model solution. So that's why this one is kind of a nice example. Well, and here's a really a wholly different kind of approach, and I'm just going to show you kind of the concept of this, but this is something that's from the Meros software, which is the Monitoring and Remediation Optimization System. And so one of their methods is more of this category method. So what you have would be well, particular well, and then you'd have a particular contaminant, and you'd do a pair of analyses on it. And these pair of analyses would help you assign that well and contaminant to one of these bins. And basically the bins are going to come out and say, well, we recommend that you sample once a quarter, once, you know, twice a year, semi-annual, or just once a year. Okay, and so the way this chart is it has two different axes, so just looking along the top, the linear regression is giving you information on the rate of change, and then the Mann-Kendall test is used to tell you whether or not the slope is increasing or decreasing, basically. And so most of the difference we see here is along the rate of change axis. So if we have a high rate of change, and then this is judged by the MCL or some other standard that you have, and it's more than two times the MCL is high, less than half is low, and then the other categories are in between. And you go from quarterly to annual sampling with that change. Then it also, in essence, is refined by whether or not the trend is increasing up here with the Mann-Kendall test or decreasing with that same test. So that's a kind of a wholly different approach, and this is something that a lot of people use, and just illustrating what another software tool is capable of using for temporal optimization. Okay, well, spatial optimization is kind of inherently more complex. So if you think about doing this by hand, you'd have to have take your wells, your plume map, and just say, well, let's take that one at a time, and then you come up with a result. And that's how you could determine whether they're redundant. Now, when you are doing it by hand, you can't really add a new well and know what the results are, and that's what some of the statistical methods can help you guesstimate what that might be. And then the strategy might be to say, well, there are certain groups of wells that look like they're providing the same information, they're highly redundant, and then other areas where you have more uncertainty. And so this is a tool that you can help to use where if data has, you know, sufficient history and number of wells, it can really provide a lot of cost savings in not providing data that's just redundant, giving you the same information. Well, and then just to give you a list of some of the methods that can be used and illustrate kind of one of the bigger issues that you might have with spatial analyses in general, but There are a variety of tools that you might have. But first, let's kind of look at this diagram here, and it's illustrating one kind of method, which is interpolation. So we have, in this case, N0 is our kind of our focal well. And then we have wells around it, you know, these five wells surrounding the focal well. And then it's using a particular kind of method, in this case, the Delaney triangle. There's also Thiessen polygons that can interpolate, basically. It's coming up with estimates of the concentration. In this case, it's distance weighted. There's other methods, and these are all discussed in that geostatistics for remediation optimization course that you should consider taking. But you can look at this, and so one of the things I like about this diagram is it illustrates, yeah, some of these interpolation methods and how you do it. You form these telegrams, but if you're actually doing spatial optimization, and this is actually what you're looking at in terms of a focal well and these neighboring wells, well, in essence, one of the big issues is edge effects. So in this case, it's like all edge because all these wells out here, you don't have any other information on any neighboring wells, right? So that's like the worst case scenario. And this is obviously just showing you a piece of a network. But when you come to the edge, you have to be concerned about that fact. And so it's one of the considerations in knowing whether or not you have the right kind of data, you know, well, monitoring network in order to apply an optimization method to. But these optimization methods, and you can imagine you could take out wells by hand. You can't really add wells and know what the result's going to be. And so that's where it comes in with the software tools. And so the software tools are various levels of sophistication. And so the least sophisticated ones, like I said, more qualitative. You can move things or you can just look at the maps and say, well, here's areas where we don't have information. The most sophisticated ones are these things that are called genetic algorithms, which really don't have anything to do with genetics or evolutionary biology. They're actually computer programming tools that can help you come up with a solution for what could be a highly complicated optimization problem. So they basically look for areas, you know, spatial domains and combinations where these are more likely to give you better information. And so if you look at something that implements this, it's like GTS Smart, which is one of the software packages we'll talk about here in a second. Slope factors and relative errors is something that's used by Meros. Kriging uncertainty is used by VSP and some other tools. So the kriging is a specific kind of geostatistical spatial method. Okay, well, just for kind of another example and a feel for how some of these methods work, this is a screenshot of the GTS software, which is this geostatistical temporal spatial software. Again, we have some information on the software in Appendix D if you'd like to read more about it. But one of the things you do with this particular software is that you can import some site information. In this case, you can see there's some site plan information here, roads and buildings and such. And then you're overlaying a grid. It's going to overlay a grid of locations. And what it's going to be doing at these locations is estimating what the concentrations are. In this case, it can deal with more than one contaminant. So that's why if you look at this location, we have a circle and another circle here. So it's giving us information on multiple contaminants at across this area. And the circles are sized by the uncertainty. So the bigger the circle, like here, we see some very large circles. The more uncertainty we have, the smaller the circle, and basically if we just see one, these two contaminants are lying on top of each other. So there's very low uncertainty here, relatively low here, but very high uncertainty here, and the information which is based on these existing wells. You can see the existing well structure. There's quite a few in certain places, and you can see that there are some areas where there's a lot of wells and relatively low uncertainty. And so these obviously would be candidates for removal. And if you use the software tools, it will come up with its recommendations based on some computer programming algorithms. Okay, well, then to kind of summarize this section, so with when you're doing optimization, chances are if you have enough data to do it, it's probably going to be more data than would be useful to do was just by hand, and so you're going to want to use a tool. And so we've listed some of the tools here that are in Appendix D. We've talked some about them already. We talked about the Visual Sampling Plan, Meros, and GTS software. There's also the 3TMO and the Summit tools, which can do some of this work as well. So basically, these tools kind of go from the more simple to the more complex. So you have to look at your particular case to see which one is applicable. For, you know, for example, the visual sampling plan software will do spatial and temporal optimization, but it does it separately. So you have to do the temporal optimization, then you have to do the spatial optimization, pull them together. The GTS, as its name suggests, actually does them the two things together. So that's kind of a nice aspect to it. And so with that, I'll turn the presentation back over to Harold.
Okay, thank you, Randall. And as we summarize the training today, to conclude it, I'd first like to go over a little bit more detail, three other sections of our web-based document, GSMC document. First of all, in section 5, where we talk about statistical methods, what the team has done is group all the statistical methods used on environmental data, groundwater data, into different groups based upon their application. So, for example, you might have the graphic methods, the methods that do confidence limits. And what you can do at this point is click on one of them, like trends, and it'll take you to the list of the trend methods. It'll give the application relevant study questions that method will handle, the assumptions that you have to use, the requirements, the strengths and weaknesses, and where you can get additional information. Remember that our web-based document is not a how-to, but a resource document. And what we do in each method as well is refer you to the EPA's unified guidance where you can get more information and specifics on how to actually do that method, how to calculate that method. Then, as Randall was talking about, our Appendix D, the team has put together these 23 widely available packages, and what these methods do, these software packages do with the environmental data, so that they may not be specific for environmental, but they're also business packages that do general statistical packages. So what the team has done was picked out what they felt like was the 23 most commonly used packages at that time, and looked at the packages, made out a different, found out the approximate cost for them, the operating system, the ease of use, how you import data into it, their capabilities, their benefits, and references to them. And so that you might click on one of them, and it would give you all that information. Then under there's a link there where it says statistical functions, and if you would click on that, it'll bring you to the capabilities table where, so for this specific method, it lists the different, this is just sort of a partial screenshot, but it goes through all the different statistical methods, and if it has a full filled-in circle, that means it's fully capable of doing that method. Half means it has some ability, and then if it's blank, it has no ability to do that method. So as you can see in this one, it would handle the simple substitution or the Cohen's approximation to handle the non-detect. And as I said, this was back in 4 years ago now, and so when you would go to these different methods and read about them, you would also want to go to the reference site to check to make sure that it's current information. So in any case, you would want to make sure that these statistical packages are doing what you would want them to do. Then one last section, the section 6, is this groundwater data management. As we remember back to the beginning about the drowning in the groundwater data, what we would suggest is that you would look at section 6, First of all, in Section 3, where you would discuss the DQO procedures and figuring out just what data it is that you need, what data is useful for the process you're wanting to do, and then look at setting up a database to manage your data. You can go to different ones that are listed here. Different federal programs have these large databases, or you can go into Section 6 where we outline how you set up a database and so that you can streamline your data analysis and have a basic consistent structural approach to managing your data. We want to point out also in this that as far almost all laboratories now have the electronic data deliverable format so that you can have them set it up so that you can just have it directly put into your database and before you even do any analysis on the data. Then as we go to a summary of the training, remember we said that this document and this training will help you be more confident with your statistical concepts, better able to select the appropriate statistical method for your project, and understand or figure out which software tool would be best for your project. All these were things that were discussed. Then as we discussed the different problem statements, we discussed determining your background, understanding compliance, whether you're in compliance or not, and implementing a trend analysis. And lastly, Randall talking about monitored optimization. These were four key areas, but as all the trainers has explained, there's many more options available in the web-based document to go over. So in closing, let me recommend that you go to this listed URL that you would link to our web-based document and allow it to guide you through the appropriate statistical methods and answering common problems that you have with your groundwater data. In any case, we want to make sure that this web-based document, the GSMC document, becomes part of your toolbox in evaluating groundwater and managing groundwater data. And with that, I'll turn it back over to Mary, and thank you for your time.
Thank you, Harold. We do now have time for our second question answer period. I did pull up a couple polls. If you could take just a few moments to answer theirs, we would appreciate it. Also, I wanted to let you know we do have links to additional resources. Not only can you access the guidance document that served as the basis for this training, there's several other links available to you as well, as noted in the second bullet. And also, we really do want your feedback. So if you would take time to fill out the feedback, that would be very helpful. Also, if you need to document your participation on today's training, please fill out the feedback form and then make sure you check the box at the end, submit that, and that will generate a certificate and a confirmation email for you. Let's get to a few questions. The first one is, how is seasonality adjustments done?
I think I'm off mute now. So the particular example we gave in Appendix A, you can see some of the details there, but basically what you have is, like I was trying to show on the slide, it's an analysis of variance type calculation. So you have an overall mean. The other thing you'll have is a mean per event. So like the October event has a mean. And so then you're going to calculate the adjusted value by accounting for those two basically levels, like an analysis of variance. So you have a factor of an overall mean, then you have an October mean, and then you're going to calculate a difference, a residual, and that's how it comes up with the adjusted values. So, it's a little bit complicated to say. If we had a graph board, I could show you more graphically how it is. It's pretty simple when you think about it that way. So I think you can look at the Appendix A, and you can also see some of that same information that's in the And the EPA Unified Guide, that's actually where we got that particular example from. So hopefully that helps.
All right. In Appendix D of the document, which tool provides Man Kindle software?
I think there's multiple of them. And Harold, I don't remember off the top of my head if the Man Kindle is a particular dot on there in terms of whether or not it has that tool or not. Is Harold still on?
I'm sorry, I was busy on another line.
Okay. Yeah, there was a question that came up about, and I saw that the Man Kindle tool, is that one of the dots that's actually in the chart for the software?
Yes.
Remember?
Yes,
yeah,
I think
okay.
So.
So basically, there'll be more than one piece of software that can do that, and you can just look at a chart in Appendix D to see which ones have that capability. And so either be no capability or full capability, and then there's some that have partial capability.
Right, Randall. The Trent. So what it will do is it'll have a list of three or four different Trent methods, and Man Kindle, Sin, Slope, you know, and linear regression are three of them that it'll tell you about.
Okay.
How do you select background wells for sites where there may not be unimpacted areas of similar lithology?
Well, that's a good question. I guess when it comes down to selecting background wells, it's kind of in discussion with the regulators, so practical constraints like that come into play. So I suppose that's one reason why you look at alternatives. If it's possible to use any intra-well testing, then that might help. But, yeah, you'd have to find a lithology which I guess is geochemically as similar as possible if you can't find one that's identical. So I don't think that there's any better answer than if Liz is still on the line, wants to tackle that one or...
Sorry, I had to take myself off mute. That's kind of a difficult one. My recommendation is that if you've got two different lithological units, you might want to look at them both together and then separately and see what it comes out looking like.
I do want to give our phone line audience a chance to ask a question. If you have a question, please state your question verbally. All right, we'll move on to the next question here. It says, are some of these tools for optimization not easily applied to sites where contaminated groundwater is in fractured bedrock?
Well, yeah, that would be... A conceptual model question that may make it more difficult to apply some of the methods. I think you'd have to mean basically you're looking at where, in essence, the spatial tools, they're kind of assuming a certain correlation over space, but if flow is mainly through fractures, then the flow is kind of preferential pathways, and it may be more difficult to, you know, determine that. But in essence, with the tools are in application of them is fairly sophisticated, and make a point plug for that GRO class, but they don't directly address fractured flow. I don't believe in the training materials there for that class, but it's certainly a consideration in terms of the spatial correlation and structure of your wells. And it's just like the lithology question. There's probably no really good general answer to that, and it could depend on your specifics and what you're trying to optimize, because it may or may not matter as much if you have a really good correlation, because what you're trying to do is estimate a property over the whole plume, so the plume mass. So I think there are certain cases where they may not have a problem, but there's other cases where if you're trying to estimate things over the short scale, then that fractured flow and preferential paths can definitely cause problems with the optimization tools.
And that class we were just referencing is coming up on October 26th. The registration is open for that class. So if you're interested in that, feel free to register. If that time and date doesn't work for you, we always have archives available as well. Well, we have come to the end of our time today, and I know there's a lot of questions that we didn't get to. If you really do want that question answered and we didn't get to it, please email us at training@itrcweb.org, and we will do our best to follow up with the trainers to get your question answered. I wanted to thank our